the lecture for Biochem 421 for October
30, 2009. All right, ladies and gentlemen, today is October 30. Last day, well, next to the last day of October. It's next to the last day, yes. Tomorrow, of course, is, yay! Although, again, I don't know why I said yay.
Candy?
Yeah, I do like candy. But, seems odd, though. Celebrate something about living dead. Cor, what's...
Pumpkins.
It's one of the more funny jokes is you see this every once in a while posted around on certain businesses on the walls. It says, if you don't think the dead can live again, wait till 5. Or wait till 5 p.m. If you don't think the dead can live. Get it?
Oh.
They wake up when they get done with work. Yes.
What's the test over next week?
Everything. Yes. And when is the test next week anyway?
Wednesday.
All right, I'll try to post something this weekend in terms of the exact content and a practice test. Well, you know, is it, what? Is it 7 chapters already?
Yes.
Is it really?
Yes.
Nice. One question a chapter. What? Yes, it is. 7 is... The number of good luck as well. I suppose we could. Yeah. Well, let's finish. Fine. I can. We can do that. Yes. I think so. Isn't it? The very last part is. Yeah. I'll have to double check, but it's certainly 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. What? Yeah. See? Okay. It's only 6. It's not 7. I thought it was a little high, but no, it's a bunch of chapters. We can cut it off today, I think. It probably wouldn't be a problem. Give you guys a chance to actually study it. But the test is Wednesday, is that correct? Yes. It's not on a Tuesday or Thursday, so I don't have to worry about back tea, is that right? And there's nobody. Does anybody have a class on Wednesday morning at 7:30? No. All right. So I might start a little early. Keep the test about the same length, but start a little early. I'll have to double check. I'll let you know. I'll put it on D2L, and I'll try to do it as soon as I can. All right. Yes. If we take it on Wednesday and you get 3 school days, including the day of the test, I should just say 2 days, but that means it has to be done by Friday. Okay, it has to be done by Friday. This is not even on yet. Oh my goodness! What did you ask again?
Around on Friday because Friday's hard because it's a short day.
Yeah, you can arrange for me to stick around. Yep. All right, well, let's begin today with a word of prayer, shall we? We'll have a quiz and we'll probably start it right around 10 after. Dear Lord, again, thank you for the rain that's here to refresh the earth. And may it also replenish the aquifers and Lake Michigan to... keep us all together for the coming winter and following summer. We're grateful also that you have given us the seventh day coming tonight and tomorrow, a chance to step away from our responsibilities and to enter into peace and rest and to renew our relationships with you and with our friends and family. We thank you for that privilege. We ask that you would send your Holy Spirit to encourage us to take full advantage of that and might not be distracted and not be distracted by things and events that are not spiritually supportive. Thank you so much for hearing this prayer. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, also this weekend is the famous Fall Back weekend. So guess what that means? Yep, happens Saturday night. So you get 25 hours on Sunday if you do it right. You don't change your clock until 10 a.m. on Sunday. 10 a.m. becomes 9 a.m. and you've got another hour there of study. So I think we should just go ahead and do up through chapter 15 on the test. What do you think? Because of that extra hour? Right, Christiana? Yeah. All right. Now then, catalytic efficiency, ladies and gentlemen. Catalytic efficiency. Can you have a perfect enzyme? And this is October 30, I think. I said that already. Yeah. The upper limit for the KCAT divided by KM value is the diffusion limit. The rate at which E and S diffuse together. The rate of E and S diffuse together. Fuse together. So, you've got two compounds floating in solution. And they literally kind of wander toward each other. Okay. So, the model really very simply is this. For example, if this is the enzyme, this is the substrate, we're all in solution. You don't mind if I touch that, do you? Oh, okay. Oh, she's just checking. What? Whoosh. Yes. Yes. Would have been a little less of a problem than dropping your computer, but... any rate, if this is the substrate... And that we're all in liquid, what's causing this thing to come closer to the enzyme? Diffusion. Okay? Well, if you got one substrate and one enzyme molecule in a liter, I mean, they're never going to find each other. But at a reasonable concentration, there's hundreds of thousands, untold billions of these floating around, a few hundred of these at least, and eventually they run into each other. Boom. The limit... The fastest that these two can contact each other is how fast this diffuses through a liquid in a random motion. That's the diffusion limit. There are many enzymes that, as this contacts, and a half an instant later, you get a product. But there are a few enzymes that are considered to be perfect. And that is their activity, their reaction rate is so quick that as soon as a substrate touches the enzyme, it catalyzes it. It's as fast as diffusion can bring it to that enzyme. That is remarkable that an enzyme would be that fast because the enzyme really... Can I lift this up? Is it later on now? The enzyme actually is a three-dimensional object and is floating around, turning and twisting... in solution, even as the substrate's coming in. Many times, the active site is not all over the enzyme, but perhaps might be, for example, in the bottom here. Well, here's this diffusion enzyme. Here's this substrate coming in, and this thing floating around like this. And somehow, the enzyme and the substrate immediately touch at the active site. If there was a delay, you'd see that in the calculations, but... Despite the fact this is a three-dimensional object, it's moving all around, somehow the approach of the substrate orients the enzyme correctly to attack the active site. It's really remarkable. So, the KCAT, or the catalytic constant, is called the turnover number, the number of reaction events per active site per unit time. Now, notice here what I said, per active site per unit of time. So, if you have a 0.1 millimolar solution of an enzyme, but it's got two active sites, it has 2 millimolar active sites, and that's what you'd use in the calculation. For simple reactions, of course, K2 is KCAT. Did I go through this already? No, okay. The KCAT-KM is a catalytic efficiency. That's the rate varies with how often the substrate enzyme contact each other. Some enzymes have reached catalytic perfection. Catalytic perfection, ladies and gentlemen. Kind of like your biochem instructor. Catalytic perfection. Perfection in teaching. Yeah, at any rate, yeah, the polite, embarrassed laugh goes, he has no clue, how ridiculous that sounds. The rate of reaction is equal to diffusion control limit. They react as fast as the Brownian movement, and the solvent brings the substrate to the enzyme. All right, and so here you go. You've got some here that are extremely high. This carbonic anhydrase has a value of 3 times 10 to the 7th. And 10 to the 7th, 10 to the 8th values, 10 to the 9th values are near or at the diffusion control limit. In other words, you can't get the enzyme any faster. So it is an important idea, and it's simply the combination of the KCAT value divided by the KM value. And that gives you an idea of how fast the reaction is moving relative to the diffusion. All right, let's go here. Vmax equals ET over KCAT VT. Do you have that equation there? KCAT equals Vmax all over ET. And again, that ET is the number of active sites in this calculation. Not always in the other sites, but in the other calculations, but in this site it is. Now, this is a little out of this particular diagram. Is that the order that you have next?
Yeah.
This is a little out of order, and so I've got to come back to this. And I noticed when I put it, I don't know why it's in this order. I apologize for this. This is the Lineweaver-Burk plot of pure uncompetitive inhibition. That's a way ahead of ourselves. But at any rate, let's go on to the next plot where it says linear plots of the Michaelis-Menten equation. Be able to derive these equations? Not really. I'm not going to ask you to do this on a test or even on a quiz. The algebra is fairly straightforward. It is not crucial. But you do need to know that both of these are linear equations. We're going to focus on the Lineweaver-Burk, but we're going to be looking a little bit, just a glancing blow at that Haynes-Wolf. And why it says Haynes-Wolf is the best, it's smaller and more consistent errors across the plot because, as I'll tell you why. Now, here is that Lineweaver-Burk plot. And notice there's the linear equation above it, and you see that the data makes a straight line, which is that at least idealized. Notice what the two axes represent. The independent axis represents the inverse of the substrate. And the dependent axis, or the y-axis, represents the inverse of the velocity. And as I showed you earlier, it has a tendency to compress the data at large values and expand the data at small values of substrate, and that can induce errors. Let's remember again, and you need to recall this, what is the slope value? If you get a value for the slope, it actually represents the fraction of what two numbers, what two constants? There you go. And the y-intercept is what? And the x-intercept is the what? Negative 1 over the km. So you must recall that, ladies and gentlemen. You must recall it, and you must be able to do calculations based on that. And I'm going to give you some practice homework for that. I'm going to give you some practice homework on D2L. I'll post it this afternoon before I go home. It'll be three questions. And I'm going to three questions with data and so on. I am then going to post the answers to it. I want to see the work that matches the answers. In other words, I'll give you the problem, then a separate thing, I'll give you the answers. I want you to ensure yourself that you can work independently, that is, on a test, and get these answers correctly. Right? So therefore, I'm going to give you the data will be there, but there'll only be 3 or 4 data points. And 3 or 4 data points so that you don't have to do a lot of manipulation. From those data points, I want you to figure out how to get the Vmax and Km. Now, whether you do it by hand using a graph or whether you're using a graphing calculator, I don't care. You will not be able to use your computer to do it on a test. I may just give you the line of the equation, any number of things. But be aware, you're going to have something to do, so pay attention to that come Sunday. They will not be hugely time-consuming. It's not going to be a calculus-type homework question or set of questions, but anyway. This is the Haynes-Wolf plot. Here you can see where there is, again, the horizontal or x-axis is the substrate, not the inverse of the substrate, but substrate. And the vertical axis is the substrate over the velocity value. And so you have an interesting situation there. This is where the slope is 1 over Vmax. Again, the intercept in this case is directly read as the negative Km. That's kind of handy. And the y-intercept is the Km over Vmax. And you can identify that by looking at the y equals mx plus b form of that equation. I probably will not be asking you too much on that. The Haynes-Wolf plot is not something that you're expected to see. I mean, in standardized tests and stuff, if they ask about the enzyme kinetics, it's almost invariably the Lineweaver-Burk plot. All right. What we're going to do now is we're going to skip some mathematics and get into some enzyme activities for about 3 slides. And then we're going to come back to enzyme activity. Enzyme activity, of course, is based on a variety of factors. One of the most important factors is the pH of the environment. This graph here, entitled pH Activity Profiles of 4 Different Enzymes, illustrates the pH dependency of enzymes and their activity. Notice on this graph, the vertical axis, or y-axis, is the relative activity. The horizontal axis, or independent variable, or the x-axis, is the pH. And you can see, for example, like pepsin, which you would expect to exist in an acidic environment because it's a digestive enzyme in the stomach, has its activity peak around 2 or less in terms of a pH. Trypsin, which is also a digestive enzyme, but is in a different environment. Pepsin occurs, can be secreted, is typically secreted in the stomach. But trypsin is secreted, and so is cholinesterase. Trypsin is secreted in the duodenum, or duodenum. I don't know how you pronounce that. That's up to you. But the duodenum, or duodenum, is the part of the small intestine just after the stomach. And it has it receives secretions from the pancreas and from the liver that are highly basic and neutralizing to the stomach acid that you find here. So trypsin, oddly enough, has a pH activity that peaks pretty close to neutrality because of the relatively neutral pH of the duodenum. Then you can see here, so just comparing and contrasting those two, that you can see that pH is an important role in the activity of the enzyme. That is because enzymes are proteins, and proteins have to be folded correctly to be activated. So these, like pepsin, is folded correctly at pH 2, but not folded correctly at pH 6. Trypsin would be folded correctly between 6 and 8, close to about maybe 7.5, and not be folded correctly at 4, or not be folded correctly at 10. And so this unfolding, or the denaturation, which is pH-dependent, as you recall, affects the enzyme's activity because an enzyme is protein. You unfold the protein, you whack the enzyme activity. Temperature here, the effect of temperature on enzyme activity. The relative activity enzyme is fluctuation of temperature. The decrease in the activity above 50 degrees Celsius is due to thermal denaturation. I actually would prefer a little different graph than that. That is a nice bell curve, almost a bell curve. My understanding and my act, the way I act on thermal denaturation is a little different. In this case, this is an unknown enzyme. It's simply what it is. Let's see, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50. Assuming that you have a mammalian enzyme in a cell, typically it's going to find its best activity around 30. Whoops, I missed that. Oh, that was such a nice curve. Around 36 or so, or there. And it begins to tail off as the temperature gets higher. But what happens typically is that it drops off relatively quickly. There's not a nice bell curve like this. This region right in here is where the denaturation comes in. Denaturation. And the denaturation can be thought of as a cooperative process. Which means what? It means if one part of the enzyme begins to unfold due to the heat, it makes it easier for the rest of the enzyme to unfold. It acts as a nucleation site for the unfolding. And so your activity doesn't drop off quite so nicely like this. It drops off a lot steeper when you have denaturation by heat. Okay, so this, of course, will vary dramatically. What enzyme used in the PCR would have an activity that might still be useful up around 50 or 60 degrees Celsius? What enzyme is that? TAC. Yeah. Something like that. And that's this TAC. What's the first letter of TAC stand for? Anybody know? It deals with the species of it. Deals with the species of it. And some thermal something or other. Thermal, I don't know what it is. At any rate, that's what that is. So that TAC enzyme is not somebody's imaginative thing. The first letter is a species, and the second, is it species or? Yeah, thermos of what? Okay, and it is what?
Thermos aquaticus.
Thermos aquaticus. Yes, there we go. Okay. All right. Well, now, okay, so there's that two pieces of information. I'm sorry it's kind of stuck in the middle of nowhere, but it is what it is. What can we learn from enzyme activity? So now, guess what, ladies and gentlemen? We're now back to enzyme activity and enzyme calculations. What can we learn from the inhibition of enzyme activity? We know that enzymes can be inhibited reversibly or irreversibly. Reversible inhibitors may bind at the active site or some other site. Enzymes may also be inhibited in a reversible, irreversible manner. Penicillin is an irreversible suicide inhibitor. We'll talk about that more later. Penicillin is a suicide. I tell you the story about the first time penicillin was ever used. I told you that, didn't I? Mm-hmm. Oh, surely I did. Maybe not. It was in England. Stop me if I've said this before, because I don't want to repeat it. The very first time that penicillin was used, I mean the very first time it was used on a human at least, occurred in England. Of course, the scientist in charge was a guy named, what was his last name? No, not penicillin. Fleming. Fleming was the discoverer of penicillin. That was the, he's the one where the serendipity, he noticed he had a contaminated growth plate, and he discovered there were bacterial colonies that would refuse to grow next to a mold. He's going, now, why would those bacterial colonies refuse to grow next to a mold? Well, at any rate, he tried this. He started growing that mold, isolated some soluble compound out of it, exposed it to bacteria, and they just crashed and burned. We thought, well, that's cool. And he tried it on some animals, and they, you know, their infections were cleared up. You go, whoa. So let's try it on some humans. The first human he tried it on was a man, a gardener, who had a scratch on his face from a rose thorn. That scratch had gotten infected. Have you ever seen an infected wound? Where'd you see it, Ed? Your dog got bit by a cat? Oh, your dad. Did it sound like a dog? I thought I was going deaf. Okay, I am going deaf. But at any rate, your dad got bit by a cat? What happened to the cat? Ah, very good. Okay, so what did it look like? Where did? It was what?
It was oozing and
gross.
And all over. I can't really describe.
It was on his hand or on
his arm?
Arm.
Probably the nastiest thing I've ever seen. The doctor had to lance it.
Oh man! So your dad died from that?
No. Oh my God.
He didn't. Anybody here you know of that died from it, has ever died from an infection like that? Anybody here know? Nobody here, out of 50 people, knows anybody that's ever died of an infection like that? Yes, yeah, you did, maybe? Died from a what? Back in the 1800s, okay. But you didn't know him personally. Oh, I like your sense of humor. Yeah, it sounds like some kind of thing. Anyway, but I tell all the old jokes around here. You keep all the young jokes to yourself. Okay, anyway. Well, this poor man got scratched with a thorn, and he got infected. Oozy and pussy and yucky. They gave the man 2 doses of penicillin. That was all they had. He started to get better. The wound started to heal. But they had used up all the penicillin they had, and it wasn't enough to overcome the bacterial infection that was in there. From a scratch from a rose, the man died from that kind of infection. Now, that was in 1930s, ladies and gentlemen. Up until the 1930s, my mom and dad were born in My dad was born in 1911. No, that was my mom. And my dad was born in 1908. They were married in the 1930s. So my dad and mom were married in the 30s. Okay, so this is fairly contemporary. Up until that point, the only thing they had were sulfa drugs, and they weren't all that effective. And there were people dying all the time from wound infections. I mean all the time. Okay, the fact that in your lifetime, you have never met anybody that has died from an infection from a scratch or a wound is the miracle of penicillin and miracle of antibiotics. Your dad is alive because of antibiotics. Okay? Had he been born 50 years earlier, that cat scratch would have killed him. Okay? And it's only 50 years. It sounds like a long time. It's not. I'm 55. Okay? So it's amazing, ladies and gentlemen. Penicillin. Unfortunately, penicillin, while it's amazing, bacteria are even what? More amazing. And they've adapted away from being susceptible to penicillin. All right, now, let's see here. What can we do for this stuff? I want to try to figure this out here. There are, I don't know why, let's skip ahead. Skip way ahead. It says inhibition, 3 types. There are, and I don't know why this is in this discombobulated shape. I apologize for the poor order of this particular section. All right. There are ways of inhibiting enzymes that are not permanent. Penicillin is a permanent inhibition of an enzyme. It actually binds the active site permanently. The enzyme and the penicillin are destroyed, and that's why they call it a suicide inhibitor. But there are lots of other kinds, or at least three major types of inhibition that are not permanent. And we're going to go through the kinds of inhibition that they are, and why they are what they are, and what it means in terms of how we can interpret a Lineweaver-Burk plot. There are three types. There's a competitive inhibition that acts to reduce the amount of free enzyme. There's an uncompetitive, which acts to reduce the amount of enzyme substrate that produces the product. And then there's the mixed inhibition, acts to reduce both the amount of free enzyme and the amount of enzyme substrate that the product produces product. All right, let me throw some stuff up here. All right. Okay, I'm going to stop right there. You have to fill most of that in, is that correct?
No.
Oh, really? It's there? Excellent.
Are all three of these non-permanent? Is that what you said?
That all three of these are non-permanent. How can you tell they're non-permanent? By looking at this, do you see where the inhibitor is? The inhibitor is listed as a capital I. It's some compound that does the inhibition. Notice the Ki, which is the binding constant for the inhibitor, is a double arrow, double-headed arrow, which means that process is itself reversible. That's why I can say that all these are reversible. So, competitive, you have this mechanism in which I combine with the free E to produce EI. EI doesn't bind with O, so you get no EIO. Never mind. S, and you get no EIS. So, you've got a situation here where this thing gets bound up, the substrate can't bind, you get no reaction, so that reduces the amount of free enzyme. That's called competitive. Another mechanism here is in which the enzyme substrate is formed, but the inhibitor binds with the enzyme substrate. You get this ESI complex. It does not go on to produce product. Again, that binding of the I with the ES is a no reaction. Produces an ESI with no reaction. And a mixed inhibition, obviously, is a combination of both. It's an inhibitor that can bind with the free enzyme to produce EI and no reaction, or that same inhibitor combined with the ES to produce an ESI that also produces no reaction. So these are the three types of inhibition. What do they look like in a plotted sense? Let's go back, shall we? I want to show you these three kinds of inhibition and what they look like. This is the mechanism. What does the raw data, substrate versus velocity, look like on these things? Let me go back. Dun, 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 dun. And we'll hit this again. Boom, 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 boom. Okay. The first kind here of inhibition we're talking about is called competitive inhibition. And I want you to note the shape of these lines, the orientation of these lines. The flattest line in all cases is always the uninhibited version. The flattest line is the uninhibited version. So this blue line, the bottom line here, over here, there's no inhibitor. So this is just the regular enzyme plot. It gives you the Km and the Vmax and so on. We add inhibitor to it, a certain concentration, and it steepens. But notice what does not change. Notice what does not change on this idealized example. It always passes through the same y-intercept, which means the Vmax is not altered. The Vmax is not altered. What did I just say? For what kind of inhibition? And then finally, we double the amount of inhibitor, and we get still another even steeper value. The Km changes, the Vmax does not. Notice, if you would, here, what they're saying. Under normal circumstances, there's the enzyme that has multiple binding sites. The enzyme has multiple binding sites. The substrate binds normally to that circle right there, that semicircle, to get the ES. In this case, with a competitive inhibition, the inhibitor binds at that same location reversibly. So a competitive inhibitor is attacking the same active site as the normal substrate. That's why it's competitive. Okay? That's why it's competitive. It's competing for the same binding site. But notice how the raw data, the substrate versus velocity data, gives us an indication of what's going on at the molecular level. The next kind here is the pure non-competitive inhibition. Non-competitive, in which there's the enzyme substrate. There's the enzyme, and the enzyme inhibitor can bind to a location other than the enzyme substrate. The inhibitor can act on the enzyme and substrate itself. This is actually. Let me go ahead here. See the three types? See where it says mixed? Go back there and also write non-competitive. Non-competitive. Mixed and non-competitive are the same thing. Mixed and non-competitive are the same thing. What? Is it? Where does it say that? What you have is not what I have. Oh, okay, well, cool. I was actually anticipating that. Okay, good. So, back here, you see it says non-competitive. What should you also write there since you're there? Write what? Mixed. Write in mixed right here. And this is mixed, where the enzyme and inhibitor can bind or the enzyme substrate inhibitor can bind. Notice what happens here. The KMs do not change. But the Vmaxes do. The KM does not change, but the Vmaxes do. And finally, you've got this. This mixed again, which is another way of looking at it. In other words, that this is kind of This is a pure mixed, as it were. This is kind of an impure mixed, in which the intercepts do not match very well. So this is kind of like an idealized mixed. This is probably more realistic mixed. We got two more minutes here. All right. And finally, you have that uncompetitive. The uncompetitive, in which the enzyme substrate is bound with just the inhibitor, where the enzyme can bind to the substrate, but the inhibitor then binds to that complex. And you end up having a set of parallel lines. A set of parallel lines that relates that. That relates to that. And we're going to go ahead and do some more additional mathematics with it. But here are the mechanisms that match that. All right. Now, for the test, if I ask for a mechanism for either a competitive, uncompetitive, or non or mixed mechanism, I expect you to be able to regurgitate this. This is not rocket science, folks. This is really very simple. This is the Briggs-Haldane assumption in terms of the mechanism. And with a competitive, the KI, the I is simply acting on the free. Uncompetitive is acting on the ES. Mixed or non is acting on both the E and the ES. This is not rocket science, ladies and gentlemen. It is fairly straightforward. And I need for you to match the mechanism with the way it looks like on a chart. So when I gave you two parallel lines, you'd immediately know that that's what?
Uncompetitive.
If I give you something that looks like this or like this, you know that it's mixed. And if you give something like this where it reaches a Vmax, they all pass through Vmax, that's what? Competitive. Do not forget it, ladies and gentlemen. Do not. All right, well, we're done for the day, at least in this class.